Welcome to the Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are two of your hosts, Ben Yanowitz
and Jordan Yanowitz. For this episode, we interviewed Dietra Cohen and Adam Siegel, authors of Ashkenazi Herbalism and their new book, Woven Roots, Recovering the Healing Plant Traditions of Jews and Their Neighbors in Eastern Europe.
This book challenges the bleak narrative of Eastern European Jewish life by foregrounding shared plant traditions as a lens for understanding the long-standing reality of intercultural exchange and dynamic coexistence.
Woven Roots provides an important look at how plants connected Jews to their neighbors, to Christians, Muslims, Roma, German, Polish, Russian, and all the other diverse peoples who called this region home. If you'd like to get your own copy of this very significant book, it's available at jewwitches.com. That's jewitches.com.
If you like the work we're doing, please follow us on Instagram at the Jewish Diasporist Pod. Subscribe to our shared YouTube, the Hamotzi Network, and consider becoming a supporter of our podcast on Patreon. Links to all of these can be found in the description. Without further ado, we hope you enjoy this conversation.
We are beautiful people.
Adam, Dietra, it's so wonderful to sit down with you guys. We're really big fans of your books. I bought Jordan Ashkenazi Herbalism like 4 years ago when I first saw it at a radical bookstore in San Francisco. And lo and behold, here we are sitting down with you to discuss your new book, Woven Roots. My brothers described this as a profoundly important book, and I tend to agree. We're going to get into it, but before that, could you tell us each a little bit about yourselves and what really brought you to doing this work of studying Eastern European, Jewish, non-Jewish ethnobotany?
Well, thank you guys for inviting us and taking the time to talk to us. And we love your podcast, so it's a mutual.
Truly a pleasure.
My name's Dietra Cohen, and I'm originally from Philadelphia. My family's probably not, doesn't have an uncommon history. My dad's side of the family came over from probably Ukraine and Belarus before the Second World War. And so they were pretty American. My grandmother was even born in Philadelphia. And my mom's side came over from Poland after the war in the 60s. They were from a really tiny shtetl deep in the forests of Poland. And they were given the choice to leave in 1939. And they decided to go with the Red Army when they came to their town. And so they had a really circuitous route to come to the United States. And they spent a lot of time in Italy. That's where my mom grew up. And so, you know, I've got this contrast, but like I said, I'm not sure that it's that uncommon, but it kind of, neither side of my family really was religious, so I don't grow up with religion at all. One of my grandfathers was, but he's very, very, very private about it. And so just not having religion in my raising kind of gave me a lot of opportunities to like connect with nature. Philadelphia is a very, very green place. I kind of like to describe it as like a bunch of villages and a giant city all connected by a lot of forests. And so I had a lot of nature around me. And that's a place where I felt at peace and like part of a bigger universe. So that's a little bit about me and how I came to be interested in plants.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
And I'm sort of the flip side, Adam Siegel here. I'm Dietra's husband, although we don't have the same last name. We are married, both from Philadelphia, met in Philadelphia. I was always interested, I mean, my family ancestry is similar but not identical. You know, family from outside of Warsaw, family from Vilnius. Everybody came to the U.S., you know. One set of great-grandparents came to New York in like the 1870s, which is like crazy to have, you know, Jewish ancestors who were here just after the Civil War. And then the other side, they got here probably around 1902. My great aunts were both born in Poland, but my grandmother was born in New York, you know, but it was another Yiddish speaking household, like Dietrich's mom's family. My own path, I was just passionately engaged with Eastern European language studies from an early age. I was in the military, and they sent me off to Monterey, you know, 40 years ago to learn Czech. At the time, Czech was the language of the hostile threat to our American way of life. So I spent a year studying Czech and Slovak in Monterey, you know, being distracted by views of Monterey Bay. It was a great time to be in the service. And then I spent 4 years in Germany, which was odd. I mean, it was odd to be Jewish in Germany. You know, I think most people, American Jews, go through that problem of how do I relate to these parts of Europe, which I find, you know, fascinating and beautiful and exciting to be in. At the same time, you know, what am I haunted by? What is everybody else haunted by?
Yeah, somebody who very much feels rooted in the plant world. And I grew up in California. I've lived my whole life in California, and I don't really have a strong connection besides, you know, a few generations back to Eastern Europe, to other spaces where my ancestors are from, but feeling like my home is my home through my connection, my understanding of the plant world. I feel like, Dietra, this might be more like aligned with your experience than yours, Adam, but I was kind of wondering what led you to explore plants in Eastern Europe. Was this a shared passion project? Was this like a way to connect with your ancestry? What led you to write Ashkenazi Herbalism, and then what led you to writing Woven Roots?
Well, that's a great question, because my original motivation was not to write a book at all. I had grown up, you know, in Philadelphia with this family, and my parents got divorced, and my stepmother, she's really into plants and into herbalism, and she's the first person that introduced me to it when I was a teenager. And so I had this curiosity my whole life, but as a young adult, it really never occurred to me that you could do more with it than just play around with it. So, you know, I had a book that was like from the early 80s. It was a German herbalism book, and I would experiment with that occasionally. But it wasn't until like in the last 10 years that I seriously thought about going to school for herbalism. And so that's what I did, because it had been this, you know, just in the back of my mind. And I just love plants. I always had plants around. So I decided to go back to school, and I wasn't really sure what it meant. You know, what is herbalism? And as soon as I walked into the building, I went to a school in Berkeley, I just had this like overwhelming, peaceful, at-home feeling. And so I really immersed myself in it. And I guess I really hadn't realized just like this whole universe it is and was and has been for who knows how long, you know, millennia. So that was my first real immersion in it. And one of the questions that the instructors ask, and I think any herbalist that is doing an apprenticeship would probably want to have their student at least investigate or be curious about what their family's practices might have been. And people in my class came up with some answers. Some of them were from Asian backgrounds, so they had ginger, they had this, they had that. And when it came my turn to speak up, I was just like, I couldn't really think of anything, except my mom would make us like tea with lemon and honey, and sometimes she'd take an aspirin and she'd crush it up in the honey, you know. And so I had those kinds of answers, but I didn't have what I thought was a real answer. So I spent like a year trying to find something. And I, you know, I'd been a librarian for a long time, so I started to do some research in English, and I couldn't find anything, really. I mean, in what's written about, you know, Eastern Europe, because I knew my family's from there, there really wasn't anything. And so I looked at adjacent populations like Polish people and Russian. There's a Russian herbal and Ukrainian. And this is where I went for the projects that we had to do for our class, you know, that often involved ancestral stuff. So that went on for a year. And then finally, I had this one book that was on Ukrainian herbalism. And it's like it's a mimeographed document from like 1952. And it's really obscure. It's hard to find. But our library, Adam's library on campus, had it. So, and I'd been looking at it for plant information, and it's very oddly organized. So one day I'm just like, God, you know, all the people in this are anonymized, because it was like an ethnobotanical study that had been done by Ukrainians in Ukraine. But it was in English, because the woman who put it together had been part of that study, and she brought it to the United States when she came over after the war. So I decided, well, if I can't figure out who the people are who they had taken this information from, maybe if I learned a little bit about the towns where they came from, I could at least, you know, get some understanding of who these people were. So the way the towns are organized in there, they're in the back of the book. And I never really looked back there, and they're abbreviated strangely. So I started to look them up. And as soon as I started to look them up, the first thing, this is on the computer, on the internet, the first things that would come up would be like Jewish Jen. And I'm like, that's really weird. Because I never really heard of most of these towns. And then another website that would come up would be Yad Vashem. You know, I'm like, that's weird. I mean, what is this? And I talked to Adam, and I'm like, these were shtetls. And we were like, this is weird, you know? So I spent 6 months going through that book, like tearing it, not literally, but like theoretically apart, and taking the towns. I made a wall graph that was like all the towns in geographical order by oblast or province. Mm-hmm. And then where the plants showed up, and I had an X there, and I would put in the remedies that they were using. So you could see this weird pattern of like north to south and east to west. And I'm like, well, okay, but I didn't know where the towns were. So then I spent some more time mapping them on like a Google map. And then I could see that they were all along the Dnieper River on right bank. And these were literally shtetls. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is where this this survey had been done.
Right. Before the war. Before, I mean, that's crucial. You know, at the time that this ethnobotanical work was going through, these communities were still mostly, in many cases, you know, 70, 80, 90% Jewish.
Yeah. So
you had to look at the 1926 Soviet census. To make sure you had the population figures, gazetteers.
All the demographics. So that was like, oh my God, you know. I wrote my final paper on that. I did a presentation on it for my program. But then I was just like, there were a couple other people in the class who were ethnically Jewish or Ashkenazi. And so it was very interesting for them too. And so I'm like, you know, if we're interested in this, there's got to be other people who need to know this. And I can't just leave this like hidden thing just, you know, as this final project. So I thought, well, you know, I'll write an article. So I wrote an article, and it got published in the Journal of the American Herbalist Guild. But it's an obscure thing, right? And, you know, it was well received, but who reads that? Nobody, you know, I mean, except for people who
are members of the guild.
Of the guild. Right? Because that's the only people who get the journal. So then I'm like, I need to do something with this, because I can't just let this just sit here like this. You know, other people are going to need this information for a lot of reasons that I can go into, besides just, you know, knowing that this existed, this world existed. So I kind of like took it. I'm really shy. It's really hard for me to even have these conversations. So it's hard for me to even like contemplate like dealing with putting this out there. So we tried to find some publishers, and at first I thought, well, it's an academic idea. You know, the presentation's a little like on, you know, the scholarship-y side. So I started there, and no, nobody wanted to touch it. You know, I went to the one in England.
You don't, yeah. Okay. I mean, yeah, there was
a lot of different.
Not much interest.
No.
No interest, in fact.
And so then I thought, well, okay, I'll have to find some commercial publishers. And I kind of put it out there, and I didn't really, you know, it's niche. It's very niche. So not a lot of interest there either. And so I had reached out to our publisher. Not once, not twice, the third time. I'm just like, I gotta get somebody here. And I realized that I'm not contacting these people the right way. These are going to the slush fund, the slush pile. So I actually realized you have to hit an acquisitions editor. So I found one at that publisher. I sent it to her, and she's the one who got back to me. And she was very excited, and she's been so, so supportive. And the whole company has been ever since. So that's how that happened. And then once that was published, there was a quote in that book that was just so essential to us as we went through the research. And that's another story, the whole research thing. But it was a quote by this scholar and rabbi named H.J. Zimmels, and his quote was on how over a thousand years, Jews helped non-Jews, and non-Jews helped Jews in medicine and healing. And medicine alone was like this sacred. Nobody could touch it. You know, right. People helped each other. And I'm like, oh my God, that is so revolutionary.
Right.
That is so, like, that is just, it just means so much more than that statement. I mean, on the face of it, it's like a whole different way of living than we've been taught, you know? And so that was like our impetus for expanding the lens of an Ashkenazi herbalism, which set the stage, right? You know, we had to have that piece to say that there's such a much broader context for this healing that involved all kinds of people who cared for each other, even though these aren't the stories that we heard. And we really set out to find those stories, and those are some of the stories that we tell in Woven Roots.
I feel like that's one of the reasons that I feel like this book is so monumentally important, because it's not just about Jews, it's about this wider intercultural context and the relationship of people to the land. I was hoping maybe you could say a little bit on why you feel plants are important to us, maybe not just about medicinal or like food, but like how do plants affect us, and why do you study plants?
Also in particular, I think not a lot of people, like, I've used the term ethnobotany to people in conversation. They're like, oh, what? Like, it's a word that I think a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their heads around, just because we are so, so alienated from plants in general. And especially today, where, like, it's hard to even imagine having intimate relationships with plant species over generations. And I just kind of want to add that on to Jordan's question as well. Why plants?
Great question, because we're relating with plants right now, all of us. We're breathing, right? You know, we're breathing. And every breath that we take in, we're exhaling what plants need. And plants like exhale oxygen. And we wouldn't be here, literally, if it wasn't for plants. And that's, you know, I mean, that's like a hard thing for a lot of people to grasp onto. They're like, whoa, you know. But I mean, but there's even more than that. I mean, everything that we do is plant related, you know. I mean, even if we only ate meat, guess what? That meat ate plants, you know.
And at the same time, we're all drinking tea, like, we're recording on a desk made of wood. Like, plants are deeply tied to every part of our
plant fibers,
cotton,
everything. It's just like, you know, and the plants wouldn't be plants if they didn't have the land. So we're all so interconnected, and we don't even remember that, you know? And so that's another big part of, I think, just talking about these things in Woven Roots, because people don't remember this stuff, and we're not supposed to remember it, because I don't know why, you know? I don't think like that, so I don't understand why this has happened. But, you know, I can surmise, you know, that it has to do with, you know, cutting people off from just their land because it's more profitable that way. You can sell it back to them and rent it to them and, you know.
You can isolate one chemical from a plant and market it for way more.
Even the term ethnobotany. I mean, it's, you know, we all know it, right? But I mean, the term is actually credited to a specific person. There's a real Harvard Reiner Schulte, you know, who was this plant pharmacology guy whose main endeavors were to go tramp around in, you know, the Amazon rainforest and the Amazon uplands and help scope out, you know, useful, interesting, exotic plants that somebody could, you know, industrialize or instrumentalize.
Yeah. That's you get rubber. Lots of things came out of that.
His footnote, he's also the guy who was able to get ayahuasca for William Burroughs. William Burroughs ran into him, like literally ran into him in the jungle somewhere, and they sort of bonded over their shared diplomas from Harvard, and that was how ayahuasca was introduced to hipster communities.
But, you know, this still goes on. It still goes on, even though I think the academic environment denies it. It still goes on. If you search for a Linnaean name of a plant in PubMed, you will find like countless articles about that plant, how it's been used in the olden days by ancient groups, and like they're not gonna try and extract, you know, its active ingredient out of it to patent it and make some medicine out of it. So it's still going on. It's just kind of like, you know, there's a lot of layers over it so that you don't know that it's going on. But, right, you know, it's there in plain sight.
Right. People will make the argument of this is why we should protect biodiversity, because there are useful things for us still unknown. But in reality, you know, people have been well aware of the plant medicine and other ways that the plants affect us and spiritual dimensions as well. I was hoping to turn towards your ethnobotanical work, you know, the way that you have researched plants in cultural contexts. I know within this book, Woven Roots, there's a subset of plants that you call Rafua plants. They seem very important from a linguistic standpoint and also from a ritual standpoint. Like, how do these plants shine a light on like what Jewish herbal traditions looked like in Eastern Europe, and how can that maybe help us get a better sense of how these traditions were shared or exchanged with other peoples?
So when you're trying to compile an Ashkenazi herbal inventory, I mean, one of the works that we found most useful was a dictionary of plant names in Yiddish. In Yiddish, it's called the Gewichsenwelt. In Yiddish, by Mordke Schechter, who was a Yiddishist lexicographer. It's a fantastic book. It's 500 and some pages long. It is sort of and I guess it'll remain the standard work on Yiddish plant nomenclature. So the Rafua plants were taken from Schechter's work. Then, you know, we identified, we flagged all the plants that had Rafua somewhere in their Yiddish name. And Segula, there's one Segula plant in there as well, which we sort of, there's six of them that show up in Woven Roots. And it's hard, you know, it was a struggle to, what does this mean? Because Schechter actually doesn't provide a lot of information about where the plant names came from. Was it from an informant? Did he consult a text? Did he consult an older botanical dictionary, which there are a couple? He didn't. So, you know, you look at an appellation like Rafua Dicker, you know, which, you know, a Rafua plant, which is this for, a Rafua is medicine. It's a remedy. It's something that will make you better. It's from the same Hebrew root as the word for Roife, doctor. But the question is, what does a Rafua Dicker plant actually mean?
As Adam mentioned, there were five Rafua plants. And so to me, looking at Eastern Europe and the fact that these plants had this name, to me meant that I needed to prioritize them and include them in the plants that I chose. And in fact, all the plants that I chose for the ones in that section of the book are all, they all are more Yiddish named plants, because my thinking was if a plant had been given a Yiddish name, then it had to have a certain amount of importance, especially if it had a reputation as being medicinal in, you know, the bigger scheme of herbalism. Mm-hmm. That was my thinking. And these five plants, they're weird, you know? I mean, they kind of run the gamut from, like, a plant that has nothing to do with that region, rosemary. And then a couple of plants that are, like, why, you know, I mean, there's like kidney vetch, you know, and so it, with, without the ability to find a written document that said, oh yes, we use kidney vetch for exactly this thing, I had to kind of like dig into like historical information and linguistic information and kind of try to weave a story together about how this plant might have been important in this time at this place, in this place. And so that's how that section came about.
Mm-hmm. I guess I was really hoping to get a better sense. You've mentioned, Adam, that your background's kind of in Eastern European linguistics. And one thing I learned about ethnobotany is that, yes, we have our Linnaean name, our Latin binomial. That's the scientific name, but there's also common names, and plants have often many common names, and the more common names a plant has, the more culturally important a plant is. And that's a really beautiful thing about this book, is you have so many different names for each plant in many different languages. And are there any other stories that really stood out about intercultural exchange that came about through that linguistic angle on why certain plants have certain names or common names that might be from one language but are used in many different languages?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in there. The clues in a vernacular name to a plant's provenance, like for instance, like calamus root, which is clearly everybody regards it as an introduced plant. In fact, some plant historians claim that it was clearly brought by Tatars, you know, Muslim Tatars, to the Polish Commonwealth at some, maybe in the late 14th century, you know, they can really pinpoint it. But regardless, it's known, widely known as, you know, not just like folk names, but like the, you know, sort of the common non-Linnaean name is Tatar plant in Polish, Tatarka. You know, in some Ukrainian communities, it's also known as Zhidivsky Lepyacha, you know, Jewish flatbread. So, it's associated with somebody else. It's not one of our plants. Somebody else brought it to us, you know, probably Tatars from the east, or it could have been brought by new settlements of Ashkenazi Jews at some point. What's interesting is that, and something I didn't reflect upon until much later, is that that's true, the terminological richness is truer for like bushy plants and grasses and fruits than it is for trees.
Okay.
Trees usually have like one name, like everybody calls a linden a lipa, or a linden. Out. Yeah. Or everybody calls an oak, you know, a dub or a domp or something, which in no way denies the fact that they're enormously important, you know, both medicinally and, you know, magically in the communities.
You mind if there I just wanted to share a hypothesis about that. Like certain trees are landmarks, like places that if somebody was like, oh, how do I get to this place, to somebody from another culture, you know, it might help to know the same word. Oh, go to this duper. Right. And this big one, and you know, it's just another half mile past that or something, and that could help, it can maybe explain some of the linguistic conservation.
Right, which is why so many place names are named for trees. So like, I mean, all the, you know, all the places in Central and Eastern Europe that are named for linden, you know, right, from Leipzig to Unter den Linden in Berlin to Lipetsk, where your aunt was born, you know, Lipava, and, you know, or all the different Ike, you know, oak towns that are all over the place. Oakland, we used to live in Oakland. I just thought of that, you know. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But certainly, I guess the affection for plants that comes through, especially the diminutives, like, you know, like languages that can make diminutive, like, you know, like Yiddish, you know, with all the little Rosh Chodeshel, you know, Segula, you know, Rosh Chodeshel. for calendula.
The little version.
Yeah, the little one, or Sanical, which is Refuyahul.
Right.
You know, the little Refuyah, the little Refuyah plant that does it all. You know, those are, but those are instances where we knew when we encountered those names that it wasn't just, oh, Schechter's just taking Rosmarinus officinalis and putting a Refuyah dicker because that's the Yiddish word for officinalis. No, these, those plant names like Refuyahul and Segula Rosh Chodeshul are clearly vernacular names.
And sure enough, I mean, rosemary is a very important plant, even in Sephardic communities as well. And, you know, there were quite a number of Sephardic migrations, you know, and even in, I think, a town that was close to my grandparents' town, Zamosh, you know.
Yeah, there was this big Sephardic community there up in the 19th century, as late as the 19th century. Yeah.
Rosemary is one of those plants that's native to the Iberian Peninsula and is the theory that Sephardic Jews immigrated into Eastern Europe and brought these seeds with them and brought the plants with them through that.
Yeah, or it could have come, you know, the other way through Greece and, you know, the Mediterranean. Yeah. And I did a little bit of reading on just rosemary doesn't grow in certain parts of Eastern Europe, so it had to be brought in as like a start or a potted plant. And sure enough, you know, it shows up in I think the certain Jan the king.
Oh no, yeah, that's yeah. You're looking for earlier accounts of rosemary as a medicinal plant, in especially in Russia. And it shows up in like the Romanovs and the Tsar's pharmacopoeia. So clearly rosemary, like that's also, what are elite plants and what are common plants? And rosemary was clearly an elite plant, you know, because it had to be, because somebody had to buy it and then protect it and keep it going, you know, usually indoors or protected from the elements. I mean, imagine trying to keep a rosemary. For those of us who are all in California, try and imagine keeping a rosemary going in, you know, in St. Petersburg.
Right.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine. It's kind of interesting to think about the different contexts in which some of these plants are growing, because like to think of like a pharmacopoeia, like this is a maybe a greenhouse in which the elite of society are able to have all the world's plants at their fingertips in case they need it for different remedies, because this was before modern medicine. I think it definitely speaks to the way in which plants end up in places that they maybe wouldn't end up without human dispersal, human intervention. And I think this brings us to an idea of like a diaspora of plants. And I know we've talked a lot about diaspora of people on this podcast, but in thinking about, I mean, diaspora, Jordan's talked about this, like diaspora comes from the Greek for dispersion. And we talk a lot about seed dispersal in terms of plants. And that's something that happens whether or not people are involved. But often it's like birds eating a seed and then pooping it out somewhere else.
Or the plants dispersing themselves. I feel like when you're thinking of like, what are the plants that were only available to the upper echelons of society versus plants that anybody could go out and gather, it's these plants that were sustaining themselves, that were able to spread populations far and wide, like the like dandelion, like the plantains. I feel like these plants really do emphasize that, you know, we're not the only creatures moving and surviving.
I mean, we can argue, you know, plants as refugees, you know, plants that have to migrate because environmental conditions have changed. They can't, you know, it's too dry or too hot or too, you know, they're like any other refugee population. They've got to get out of there. And they do so.
Even more so.
Exactly.
It does beg the question of human responsibility. I mean, this idea of people literally taking a potted rosemary out of Spain and through the Mediterranean up to the Black Sea and into Russia, perhaps, is a really interesting, you know, that's somebody who cares deeply about this plant and is taking care of it on a ship for maybe months, and then ultimately it's able to get it where it can survive and be propagated again and again and again. And, you know, some plants don't receive that love. Some plants are ostracized or, you know, deemed as weeds, and we just pour chemicals on them to kill them. But they just also have to, you know, keep surviving and do what they can.
I have a question I'd like to ask, because we've talked a lot about individual plants, but one thing that I think is so interesting about looking through woven roots, and Jordan kind of already spoke to this, most of the book is organized by individual plant species. And on the page, you have a beautiful sketch of it, and then you have a list of names in all sorts of languages, from the Linnaean term, then you have the Yiddish term, the Polish term, Ukrainian, Belarusian, Lithuanian, Russian, German, all these different languages with their own names for it. And it speaks so much to this either intercultural exchange or just shared traditions that are really not necessarily visible to most people at all today. And I guess I have a few questions on that, which is, one, of course, this is going to be different from plant to plant. Is it a directional relationship of one tradition bringing it to other traditions, or one culture bringing it to other cultures? Or is it cultures coming together who all share this already just because they live in proximity to these plants, in relationship to these plants? I'm just really curious about how these different cultures relate to each other through these plants as maybe like intermediaries.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, there's so little written about that one-to-one, really intimate relationship around plants. And I wonder if that's because so much of it was women's medicine and that was never written down. So just their interactions were never written down. So, I mean, we've really tried to discover some of that or rediscover some of that, and it's come through things like memoir. There's that Pauline Wangerow, Memoirs of a Grandmother, and she has a passage on this grandmother who was a midwife. And I don't remember that being particularly about intercultural exchange, but there are Yizkors that do talk about this. There's one in particular that we found of a Christian midwife who spoke fluent Yiddish and would, you know, deliver the babies of everybody in the town. And she was the beloved midwife. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter that she was a Christian. She, you know, spoke your language and she took care of you, you know? And so that was one right. story.
She said the prayers in Yiddish. She said Jewish prayers in Yiddish. This isn't a town that was mostly Jewish and they had the midwife was Christian.
And then there's another story about a healer, a Jewish healer, who was beloved by everyone. Mm-hmm. And you probably know that story a little bit. Do you remember that one? I can't remember her name. Maybe.
Oh, I want to say it's Sura Yosef, but it's not her.
Yeah. Well, we can't remember her name, yeah. But she was just
anonymous, like so many. She's, you know, we mentioned her in the book, but, you know, mm-hmm. from the tip of my tongue, she's anonymous.
Yeah. But there are stories like this, and they're scattered about, and this is, you know, where you can find this exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the stories of the men healers. I guess this tends to kind of like break down along, you know, gender lines. But, you know, like the Felcher, who was the medic in a town. And, you know, there were Christian Felchers and there were Jewish Felchers. And, you know, they all worked with the community. And so these are the relationships that would, you know, transpire. And this is where the contact happened. And, you know, we keep looking for these stories because they're important just mm-hmm. to remember that this is another part of life, you know, that our families had, you know, and it was a positive part of the story.
Yeah. And there's also another sort of, I want to say valence, but valence isn't the word. The distinction between plants that were cultivated, plants that were wild foraged, and plants that were purchased at the market.
That's true.
And all three of those types of plants as medicine were hugely important to these communities. So when you're asking about the relationship between people and plants, obviously wild foraged plants are the most sort of indigenous to the region. And the attitude toward wild forage plants is kind of it's kind of barbed. It's ambivalent. And I think that's because people tend to treat wild forage goodies as a secret, something mm-hmm. to be kept from other people. I mean, we actually just went through this. We've you know, a secret stash of St. John's wort in bloom on the American River, you know, outside of Sacramento. you know, and like, ooh, our little secret St. John's Wort spot. We were out there a couple weeks ago to get some because we knew exactly where it was. No, don't tell anybody. But, you know, that's true. And you do see this in Yizkor's and in things like I.J. Singer's memoir. If you've got like an old woman wandering around at night gathering plants in secret, you know, A, she's probably practicing, you know, she's drawing on her indigenous knowledge of the region. B, she's gathering things for some deliberate purpose. Hopefully she's, you know, doing it to cure or help somebody and not a witch, Makshefe. But three, she might be perceived as one because it's suspicious. Yeah. Nobody, women shouldn't be out after dark. Women shouldn't be creeping around by themselves, you know, in the bushes gathering things. It's suspicious.
It does feel like that when you say it's barbed, that this cultural view of, you know, witchcraft that kind of brewed around the modern, early modern period might be coloring that as well. I don't know how widespread that was. I know it's definitely an English phenomenon, but I'm sure
there is a mention of it in I.J. Singer's memoir, From a World That Is No More. So that's kind of an interesting little piece that we'd left out of the book, but thought about putting in.
But we did note in passing in the book that while there was persecution of suspected witches in Eastern Europe, it was nowhere near as murderous and exterminating as it was in Western Europe. Or, you know,
it seems like women's medicine and secret ways were more tolerated. But I also wanted to add another piece, which is, we read in this Polish ethnobotanic survey that also was a little bit earlier than the Ukrainian one, that the spice merchants were all Jewish, and they sold and traded in exotic spices and other herbs. Mm-hmm. So everybody had to go to this person, and this is in the chapter on the Trianka. I don't know if you've gotten to that part in the book, which is, to us, is like the heart of the book. It's very, very, it's so strange and important because it's something that's lasted from the ancient Greeks up until, you know, the 20th century. And it involved these Jewish spice merchants, and they, you know, interacted with people who came to them for formulas and just components of formulas. So, yeah. And actually, it goes beyond the Eastern Europe and the early 20th century. It came over to the United States, and you can see that in that list of the Trianka ingredients of, you know, quote unquote, Russian pharmacists. And we kind of speculate, did these formulas come from their grandmothers?
Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit about what Trianka is?
Strictly speaking, the Trianka was a compound of different herbs, usually distilled. You'd infuse it like a vodka infusion. And it would be, you know, the ingredients would vary, but usually Trianka, for anybody who's worked with in Eastern Europe, well, anybody who knows in European language, Trianka suggests like a troika, something three, right? Three. So you're like, well, it's got three ingredients. No, the Trianka typically has. I mean, like a 11. Yeah. It's a real, but the common elements were usually like centipods, vanilla, sometimes there's Saparilla gentian, carob, English, allspice.
Looking at the list, it does seem like a lot of the Havdalah spices are in there, like cardamom, cinnamon, cloves, nutmeg.
Yeah. I wonder what the significance of that is.
And the first time we came across a Trianka was in Pauline Wengeroff's memoir. And it was just sort of like tossed off, you know, like, oh, and you know, she gave me the Trianka and it had these, and she lists all the ingredients. Mm-hmm. And we're like, what is that?
Right.
What is that?
And then, you know? And then we're looking at Talka Rincevich's 1893 sketches of folk medicine in southern Rus, which is to say, you know, the historic Pale settlement. And we run across the same freaking, I mean, variations, but like, I think it was 90% the same spices, 90% the same ingredients. And it was also called Troyanka.
I think it was Zapianka.
The Zapikanka too.
Okay.
But but then you start seeing it, and then once you see it, you can't unsee it.
And that author also said in his little section on that particular formula, which was used for the same thing, postpartum recovery.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing as Pauline Wangeroff was calling it out for. And that particular author who wrote before, or I guess around the same time as Wangeroff, he says that these spices were only available through these Jewish merchants. So it's just really fascinating to get all these different pieces coming from all these disparate sources and then trying to put them together into some sort of coherent picture, so that's where.
But the Trianka still exists. You can get commercial preparations called Trianka in Lithuania, apparently. We looked for it, but we couldn't find it. We were just there.
Yeah.
But they do have, I guess if anybody, I don't know, I'm trying to think of in the U.S., Jäger, do kids still drink Jägermeister?
They do, unfortunately.
Okay, that's sort of along this, it's an infused bitters that, have a blend of, a secret blend of herbs. Amaros are like that.
Even root beer, Coca-Cola. I feel like a lot of these things came out of these herbal remedies.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So
you were going to talk about the word Trianka.
The Trianka, why does it have three? Especially because the Lithuanian version is called Tris Devenerios, so three nines, which also has further, sort of elusive, interesting things associated with it. We think that because it's called, is it Trianka, Troianka, something like that, Troianka, that it's derived from the theriac. And the theriac was a sort of an alchemical, medieval alchemical panacea that was also derived, only alchemists could produce the theriac because he needed to be able to master, master chemistry, master plants, and master magic. And the original sources, it was called the Methydraticum because of some legendary Hellenic ruler of Asia Minor, I guess Mithridates or something, who wanted, had his probably Persian sorcerers come and advise him. He needed something that would repel all poisons, an antidote for all poisons. So from, the semi-legendary antidote to all poisons, the Mithridaticum, to the medieval alchemical theriac,
to the
Trianka, and that's the journey.
Does it work?
Does it work on...
I've never tried a Trianka.
But
it seems like it would be, I don't think it would taste as bad as Jägermeister, but I think it would be actually kind of a delicious bitter.
Yeah, like a gentian-based bitter. Any bitter, where there's a gentian quality in it.
And we kind of surmise that, somebody's probably going to come up with their own, Ashkenazi Trianka someday that you can buy.
Yeah.
Local apothecary.
Because, right, I can't remember what page it's on, but we found that the druggist circular were these four quote Russian pharmacists who have names like Weinstein and something. They're
Hirsch,
all from Hirsch. They're all in New York and one's in Boston.
Yeah.
And they all have their own. Here's the one that I write up. Here's the script that I write up.
Yeah.
Two parts this, one part that.
1907.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list here and I see sarsaparilla, which is the root beer plant. And it's it's interesting to think about how these remedies, these salves, kind of turned into something that got very commodified and became just kind of a sugary beverage rather than something that was intending to heal. I guess I kind of want to start pivoting towards the world we live in, where herbal remedies are kind of fringe, not really accepted by most medical practitioners. I feel like the Trianka is a really interesting spot to jump off because it does start moving us towards these more heavily processed synthetic drugs even. What was the relationship between herbal practitioners and medicine practices that way versus people who are more in the modern medical tradition?
Also, is there a gendered aspect to that as well? Because I feel like we've already kind of talked a little bit about the gendered aspect of traditional healing practices. But to me, it feels almost like there's a kind of masculinized, hyper-masculine approach with modern medicine and the development of it, especially considering it was exclusively male for a long time.
Yeah, a lot of people write about that and talk about it, and just how the whole healing was kind of wrested from, you know, a women's sphere, and maybe for control at first, and then, you know, it became more and more profitable. And I remember listening to somebody even talking about, like, gynecology, like, going from the sphere of women to men as experts on this, and just, you know, the whole idea of, you know, oh, well, the people are always going to be born, so, you know, this is a really profitable branch of medicine, you know. And so, I mean, yeah, I think there's a lot of that in it. And then there's also the aspect of moving from the more ancient ways and becoming more, quote, civilized, and that came out of the Enlightenment, which in Eastern Europe was the Haskalah. And so, and that involved just changing people's ways, you know, trying to get rid of the superstitions or what was perceived as superstition, mm-hmm. and sanitation, and medicine became more the sphere of men, and hospitals. Also, I was thinking about this today, like, hospitals really kind of, like, alienated different groups of people, because you had the Jewish hospitals, which people tried to avoid, you know, like the plague, so to speak, because if you went to the hospital, that was pretty much the end for you. And then there was the Christian hospitals, which, you know, still today, I think I knew somebody who ended up having to go to a Catholic hospital, and he was just horrified, you know, by it, because, you know, it just really separated people too. So, like, all these things kind of added up, these layer upon layer of, like, obscuring people from the land, from plants, from, you know, each other, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why plant healing could flourish in Eastern Europe, and I guess I should stop. When we say Eastern Europe, and I understand that, you know, because somebody called us out and said, well, Poland, Central Europe. And I, yes, yes, yes. We are reconstructing a world of the Pale of Settlement, which was all part of the Russian Empire, which, you know, let's just call it Eastern Europe and be done with it.
You're angering the Polish nationalists in saying that.
I don't want to do. I understand the distinction. But the Russian state did not have the wherewithal or to project sort of administrative, bureaucratic, state-sponsored medicine into a lot of these communities. It just it wasn't even an argument. Well, don't go to that old Bobeg. Go see a doctor. There was no doctor. There was no hospital. I mean, we went to the town where Dietrich's grandparents lived until they were in their mid 20s in 1939, and even now in 2025, it is really, really far away from anything else. It is not on good transportation networks. I mean, it's your family history. But even today, there are no pharmacy in the town. There's no Dr. Shingle. There's not even a grocery store. There's like a pizzeria on the town square. Maybe a gelato stand. Sorry?
This is Poland?
Yeah, this is in Poland. It's in southern Poland. And it's in a beautiful part of Poland that is in the middle of a nature preserve because it's still so isolated and remote and forested.
Yeah.
But you think about your grandparents
growing
up there. And they're, I mean, Zamość is a day's walk away through the woods. Mm-hmm. That we actually recovered an I.B. Singer story where one of the characters goes from Warsaw to your grandparents' town, Józefów, and it's like an epic slog.
We can attest to that.
We did that. And he walked all the way from Warsaw. We just walked from you know the clearing in the forest, you know, 3 miles outside of town. Yeah. But it is really far away from, and this is a part of Poland that was part of the Austrian Empire. So strictly speaking, it was Central Europe for a couple of decades. But I can only imagine that 100 miles, 200 miles further east.
So I guess what we're saying is, you know, all the towns were different, you know. I mean, even though they tried to, you know, homogenize so much, it wasn't possible, you know, because of towns like my grandparents that was so isolated.
Yeah.
And so maybe their town was one way, but another town, you know, maybe 50 miles away was a little bit more able to come into the 20th century, you know, with its own Jewish hospital and burial society and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I don't know what went on in my grandparents' town, but we can only surmise that, you know, they were picking berries and mushrooms and, you know, taking care of each other. And my grandparents survived. I mean, there were like four kids in that. Maybe, I don't know, there might have been more family. And they'd lived there since the town was founded. We traced their lineage back. And that's like going back at least 300 years. So
wow.
People were surviving on their own, even in these very isolated communities.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting hearing about that and comparing it to my own experience of going to where our great-grandfather grew up, because it was also, I mean, it was, we could take a train from Yaroslav, so it wasn't as isolated, but it was also very small, and it didn't look like there was any clinic or pharmacy. It's interesting to notice those kind of continuities of rural life, because it's not really something that is really just in the past, and I guess I'm kind of curious about how ethnobotany is still relevant today, because I think it does kind of speak to the fact that there is still huge disparities in access to modern medicine. And I guess herbal healing, like, often it is kind of stigmatized as like, oh, that's witchy, that's woo-woo, it's not so like grounded in reality and science. And I guess I was curious how you see that today. Is there still a place for ethnobotany or herbal medicine practices?
Yeah, I guess my own life for us, I like think of it as kind of like a prophylactic, just like really keep your body as healthy as possible by putting into it what is good for it. And that means not any processed food, as little chemical as possible, trying to exercise, trying to get enough sleep, just having engaging conversation and just being engaged in the world, but in a more holistic way, you know? And then I actually wrote some notes down about this from that point of view. As somebody who practices herbalism, I'm not a clinician. I was trained as one, but I don't practice that way in a community. But if I were, as somebody who might talk to other clinicians, you would want to, if you're going to work with people who aren't from your same background, it's really important to know their background and what their ancient practices might have been, because we are all built from these plants. This is where our bodies come from. We eat the plants, you know, we live amongst them, we wear them, we're sheltered by them, all that, we breathe them in. And so having that knowledge and being able to offer a client the plants that their families or their ancestors would have worked with is kind of a really just helpful way of getting their body to kind of recognize that you're, you know, trying to put it back into balance. And so just having that piece of history to kind of heal yourself with or heal someone's body with, I think is really important to bring to your formulation and to your interactions with another person.
Kind of makes me think, because we often hear the term intergenerational trauma, but what's the opposite of that? Like intergenerational healing?
Yeah, like, I've heard of ancestral healing. It does kind of edge on the idea of like woo, kind of out there, but I do think there is something evolutionarily to be said. Like, people have been using plants for tens of thousands of years, and individual cultures have been using plants for thousands of years, and there is some kind of, you know, your body does go through a lot of changes when you're healing, and the exposure to certain medicines can play a role in affecting your genetic expression in some ways. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that there would need to be really specialized science to ever like show an impact, but just there's an almost intuitive sense that like this does make sense. Like, you are reminding your body through the cues of taste, smells, the secondary metabolites that are in plants, even the ritual context of healing that can promote like your, I've heard the idea of a placebome, like this idea of the placebo effect is actually an important part of our healing, because your body has to be receptive, open to healing, or you're not going to be able to actually heal. And I think that kind of leads me to want to talk a little bit more about the ritual context of herbal healing, because herbal medicine was part of this broader, almost magical tradition within Judaism. And how did plant healing fit into this broader medicinal ecosystem, so to speak? And were there a lot of herbal traditions or other traditions picked up from other cultures, or did that kind of Jewish medicinal knowledge get passed along to other cultures? What did that landscape look like?
I think specifically of a certain ritual that was done to get rid of a certain belief that caused certain physical ailments that would manifest, and specifically talking about the idea of the evil eye, which, you know, I don't think anybody's ever traced its origins, but it does seem like it comes out of what we call the Middle East today. And so it seems to have traveled from there to what we call Eastern Europe now. And there is like a path that you can see. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it terminates there. I think it's gone. It's dispersed from there, but it does exist there still, probably today. But during this time period that we looked at, the evil eye was dealt with by a divination ceremony, a ritual that in that area was done with wax. The practitioner, often a woman, called an Absprecherin, somebody who speaks away, would take a bowl of cold water and have it over the patient's head, and they would melt wax in a pan and then dump it into the water, and the wax would make some sort of a shape. And then that would be interpreted by the Absprecherin, who would say, well, this caused your ailment. And the ailment, like I said, could manifest in a lot of different ways. For example, a child might be bedwetting. So the Absprecherin would say, well, this was brought on by, you know, fear of a dog. You know, this is all an example. And then, so once they divined what your ailment was and what caused it, they would dispense a tea, you know, based on a plant after that. And we can see like modern, even contemporary examples of this in Ukraine. There was a researcher, I think she was from Indiana, and she, there's actually a video that you can watch. I think it might be on YouTube. It's called Shapes in the Wax. And it shows, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it shows these contemporary Ukrainian women doing this ritual. And we read about it many times in the Jewish literature about Jewish women who did the same thing. And it's often garbled, but, you know, there are accounts that it's a little bit more clear. And so this is something that was shared. Maybe it came from the East to this part of Europe and somehow was shared with these different communities who were still practicing this ritual today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are several things. I mean, there are certainly, for observant Jews, there's a whole line of plant lore, plant legend, plant knowledge that you can draw on, you know, drawing from, you know, the Torah, from the Talmud, you know,
the remedy books,
just knowing, you know, having, you know, knowing, well, okay, the Havdalah plants, here's the Maror, just knowing that there are plants that are incorporated into our religious observances that we know are good for us was absolutely part of traditional healing among Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. But like Dietrich said, there was a much broader sort of magical universe of belief that was absolutely shared by all the populations of the region. We found accounts of Karaim Jewish healers in Lithuania would invoke Jesus Christ, or magical numbers. Magical numbers are huge, 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 huge in the region. 3, 7, 9, but especially 3 and 9 are just like in everything they do. You do things 3 times, you repeat this incantation 3 times, you have this magical language that invokes the numbers to do stuff. I think it's no accident the Lithuanian version of the Triankh is called the 3 nines. So that was absolutely shared in the communities. There is some stuff, but it's, again, it's how, you know, organized religion sort of takes pre-monotheistic religious traditions. Like, oh gosh, what was the floor? The stuff that you do on Pesach and then you do on Easter.
Yeah, yeah.
Calamus, of course. Yeah, Calamus reads.
Calamus on the floor. Yeah, for the scent, the sweet scent of Calamus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the springtime for Pesach and for Feast of the
I can't remember the Easter
yeah.
type thing.
Pentecost, the Pentecost.
Yeah. The same ritual was done for these two closely next to each other.
Yeah, in Poland. Jews and Christians in Poland. Yeah. Spreading calamus on the floor during the
spring. And were they aware they were doing pretty much the same thing?
Not from the sources that we looked at, no. Yeah. But it was basically identical. Yeah. I mean...
They had to have known.
Yeah.
I mean, sources are silent about so much stuff. You know, I mean, there's like, again, I bring it back to I.B. Singer because I was tracing this sort of this long trek through the woods to Yosefa. And there's another story of his where somebody's dying in childbirth. And so he even calls them the rabbis, or at least the English translation calls them the rabbis, rush in with, you know, a bowl of coals. Of burning embers. Oh. And he says nothing more about it.
Oh, okay. And that's a divination.
That's a divination.
The coal. To throw it in water, it depends on probably like the type of wood that it comes from and if it floats, if it sinks. Yeah. And, you know, some of those were very manipulated.
Yeah.
Because some coal floats, you know, and if you know the one that floats and you want to make the certain divination,
But if you read Singer without the context, you just go, okay, well, the rabbis came in, they knew what they were doing, they had the burning coals, but he doesn't even call it magic. There's this rabbinical flavor being cast over what's the standard divination ritual practiced all over the region and beyond. I mean, it occurs in all diasporic Jewish communities. It's among Mizrahim and Sephardim and Baghdadi Jews and Beni Israel. Right. It's all over the place.
Yeah. Now that's super interesting to hear the way that a shared tradition can just kind of be brought in the context and made Jewish simply by the context. And throughout this conversation, we've kind of talked and hinted at the way the work that you've done is kind of just a piece of a much bigger story. I mean, you have Ashkenazi herbalism, you could do Sephardi herbalism, you could do also like the mountain Jews of the Caucasus or Arab Jews throughout the MENA region, Middle East, North Africa. And it's interesting to think about the stories that haven't necessarily been told, because you've talked about how you have all these traders that have brought, that basically kind of Jewish traders that kind of had not a monopoly, but like were the representation of the spice trade in the region. And there's all these stories that you can only imagine, and I can't imagine the amount of work that would have to be done to really uncover them and tell the stories. But it does give us a glimpse into a wider Jewish diasporic ethnobotany. And I think that's something that Ashkenazi herbalism is just like an entry point, because I don't really think there's many studies into Jewish ethnobotany. There's like the seven species and Zionist ethnobotany, what you might say. But this diasporic Jewish ethnobotany, I think, does something else and maybe even breaks down some of the myths around Zionism as central to all Jewish experience ever.
I remember reading about the Judean palm, like seeds were found that were like thousands of years old and they were trying to grow them. And it does really bring up this idea of the ancient Near East, because these are actually ancient plants. And with Ashkenazi herbalism, we're talking about contemporary plants. We're not bringing plants back from the brink of extinction, which also is great, but it's something that's, you know, the knowledge is still here. It's still around us. And yes, a lot of it has been lost and you're recovering a lot, but there's, you know, it's not like you're trying to raise the dead. You're trying to just figure out what's present here still and to further to express that. Yeah.
Yeah. The wonderful thing about a diaspora is that you make a home where you are. I mean, we didn't even talk about this in this, you know, but one of the sources that we also drew on for Woven Roots was Garber.
Oh, yes, that's
Garber,
true.
It's a Yiddish book. You can find it online. It's what Flonson mentioned, Rufus, you know, plants, people, and Rufus.
Mm-hmm.
And Garber was a Polish Jew who went to Buenos Aires before the war, maybe in the 20s.
Yeah.
That was his aliyah. He went to Argentina, he wrote a book on...
The herbalism.
On herbalism for...
Jewish audience
in South America.
And so he has
tons
of plants. A lot of them are the same ones that we talk about in Ashkenazi herbalism and in Woven Roots, but he also has like South American medicinal plants, and it's very it's a really interesting book.
And he explicitly like the soap plant. So like one of the, you know, we talk about this because we cover soapwort, saponaria, you know, as a healing plant and a sort of a useful plant. And Garber, there's a South American soap plant called Quillai.
Yeah,
right, Quillai. And he says, this is our siphon forts. This is our, you know, this is our soap plant. You know, here we are.
Yeah.
It's our little doykite of South America. We have all these wonderful plants that we can, that, that do the exact same thing that they did back in the old country. They're just as good. Wow. We consider them the same. They're just, we can get them here. We don't have to send back to Poland for, you know, some dried soap wort.
Yeah.
If someone living in California, that strikes a chord, because we also have our native soap plant. We have bearberry. There's other plants, common yarrow, that are found in Eastern Europe, and also, you know, maybe a slightly different variety, but the same species present here. And getting to find that sense of home that crosses continents, I think, is really profound. I do think there's something to be said about, you know, also creating space to bring some of those plants that are meaningful with us. Like, a lot of people have brought pomegranates to America or other plants that mean something deep to people. I know outside of Judaism, there's lots of examples of this. But just the physical way of planting a seed as a way to
make home where you are.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, it is. It's like rooting yourself too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially when we form those medicinal or food or just even aesthetic relationships with those plants and the memories of, you know, watching them grow and flower and fruit.
I want to kind of bring it up to today because we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the modern political context. I mean, I mentioned us interviewing you very excitedly to someone who's a professor, and they were like, how can you be talking about this when there's a genocide in Gaza? And I think it's even more so after Israel launched their attack on Iran, and we're looking at a very, very scary future in which a so-called Jewish state is a vanguard of potentially a third world war. Obviously, this is heavy, but the work you're doing has kind of political undertones that maybe aren't super, like, central to what you write about, but it's very clear to anyone that is, like, aware of the context that this book has a political content. And I guess I was sort of curious how you see this study of diasporic Jewish ethnobotany, like, relating to ultimately one of the things that foreclosed ethnobotany, which is the rise of nationalism as a framework and as a political paradigm. How does this sort of work that you've done work to maybe either deconstruct or subvert? Or how do you see the work that you're doing relating to this really hegemonic nationalist paradigm and framework that has been colonizing our world?
Gosh.
Big question.
It's intense, you know, and complicated to answer. And my initial motivation for doing any of this had nothing to do with, you know, politics or any of it. But, like, over time, I feel like it's morphed into this, like, myth-busting no, a big no in a lot of ways. Like, no, I'm not going to believe this stuff anymore. But not really saying it directly, but just kind of, like, coming at it in a more gentle way. Like, there's other ways that we've been and other ways that we can be, and we don't have to subscribe to one way that's been, you know, handed down to us for I don't know how long. Maybe not that long.
Not even that long.
Not that long. But, you know, I mean, we got that, and, you know, God, it's hard to talk about. Even now, it just feels weird talking about it. But I wasn't raised with religion, so I didn't really think about it, and I didn't, it wasn't meaningful to me, and it also had this weird undercurrent of, like, oh, you have to go there, you know, at some point in your life, you have to go there, and then I would be asked, well, how do you feel about that place, and I'm like, I don't know, I don't think about it, and when I do, I'm like, I like the idea of it, but the reality is, like, a nightmare. I don't want to go there. So, and my family didn't want to go there. Even my grandparents who escaped, you know, death, they didn't want to go there. They were in Philadelphia. They didn't want to go there. They didn't want to send their kids there.
They sat in Italy for 15 years because they didn't want to go there.
They were in Italy for 15 years because they didn't want to go there.
Yeah.
Mm. And so all this, you know, swirls in my head. And so I just feel like on a very personal level, you know, I've never, because of all these things, it's always felt weird being Jewish, you know, because I do feel Jewish, but culturally, I don't understand religion. I don't get it, you know, I feel like at home in nature and around plants and people. And so for me, doing this work has been kind of like a way to feel more close to being Jewish, knowing that, you know, my people did this too. We were rooted in the land. We loved the land. We loved the landscape. We loved the other people and took care of them. And they took care of us, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is a story that, you know, needs to be told. I mean, aside from all the horrible stuff, this is also possible, you know. And so that's to me, like, you know, how, you know, if that's what you call deconstructing Zionism, then okay, that's what it is.
I just want to say, I think it's a very strong point against the lachrymose, like the depressive story of Jewish history in Europe. Like, it's always been suffering, it's always been death. But actually what you're doing is giving us a portrait of actually there was so much life, there was so much shared love of each other and community that, I mean, especially the Jewish nationalist story completely erases.
Right. I feel like a big sense of like what was lost in Eastern Europe is due to rising anti-Semitism and pogroms and then the Shoah. But what a lot of Jewish politics since then has been is like trying to further support Jewish culture and Jewish life. And what you do here, and it's in the subtitle, recovering the healing plant traditions of Jews and their neighbors in Eastern Europe. Like, yes, a lot has been lost, but we can recover it. And I feel like that's the most profound statement is, yes, this world of intercultural solidarity and collaborative healing has in some ways been extinguished, but it's possible. It's right here. And it's something that we can bring back. And it's something we can bring back here wherever you are. It's not something that only needs to be done there. And I'm just so profoundly grateful that this book exists now. And I really hope it picks up in the Eastern European and the Polish and the other contexts where people can find this and realize like this is a shared herbal tradition. I feel like so much of herbal traditions are being co-opted by the right, like the anti-vaccine, anti-modern medicine people. And like, yes, modern medicine also put a pressure on herbal traditions, but we need to, if we're going to revive these traditions, we have to do so in context and recognize that this isn't something that's owned by one culture, but it's something that's shared by all people, and we have to.
And it's not an either or situation, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we can do both. We can do all of it, you know?
No, I agree with you. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, yeah, thank I mean, I was, for... I would love it if, you know, if there was a conscientious revival of a shared tradition that's rooted in, so to speak, in Eastern European cultural history that revives. I mean, because it is wonderful. It was all, because so much of this was centered around childbirth and bringing life into the world. Mm-hmm. Again and again and again. Women healers helping bring new life into the world. Not death-centered, not, you know, more, you know, gnashing your teeth and rending your garments and, you know, dodging the Cossacks. I mean, this is where, you know, there are lots of towns where people just hung out and got along for hundreds of years.
It's crazy that that's a radical statement that people would contend against.
And it's verdant. We were just there. I cannot believe how lush. Because you just see like an old black and white picture, and it's always like a bunch of people in black standing around in the rain, you know, or it looks, you know, with like muddy ruts in the road. Yeah. And oh, it just looks so dismal, right? Yeah. But you go there, and it's absolutely staggeringly lush and beautiful. Yeah. I can't imagine spending 20 generations in this part of Europe, like up until like last week for us, and not have carry that with me, that generational sense of, oh, this is my home. That's the Doikite of the place. I mean, because it's just so unbelievably gorgeous, just physically it's really gorgeous. Pretty. And it smells amazing. There's linden, there's horse chestnut, everything is in bloom.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
That's how I feel about some of the sage scrub ecosystems in California, or the redwood forest, or the smells bring back so many memories. I feel like when we're talking about Doikite and we're talking about reviving herbal traditions where we are, I think there needs to be something said about the decolonial aspects of that needs to be rooted, like, know your local plants. And don't just like replace, you know, with Eastern European species wherever you live. There's something to be said about finding a balance and finding a balance that works for all species. And doing so with respect. And I think, you know, if there was a boom in herbal traditions, there would be species that would be seriously potentially lost. And so there needs to be some cultivation and respect and responsibility there that I feel like maybe was already present, you know, in a lot of these older traditions. But within the context of the modern day, a lot of people are very appropriative or extractive with species that we relate to.
There is an organization called United Plant Savers, and they're really aware of like the endangerment of certain plants. And they try and bring an awareness to the general public. And like, I think that's how plants like Osha have been more protected, and also certain ginsengs. There's that organization probably needs to be better supported, but yeah, they try and bring a more of an awareness to contemporary herbalism and, you know, how people gather plants.
I mean, in California, white sage is probably
exactly.
culprit of appropriation. And
so I think in our, just as we were very careful not to spend too much time talking about toxic plants, we also made sure that, you know, the plants that we profiled were not endangered or over-harvested or subject to that kind of
exploitation.
Yeah, I really appreciate that part of your method where it's not something you write about. It's just something that you're thinking about and like thinking about the impact of this book. Yeah. Like if you are playing a role in a revival of a tradition, you know.
You want to do that responsibly and
leading to the loss of any species.
I want to thank you so much for how generous you've been with your time. And to wrap us up, I'd be curious if you have any anecdote from either writing the book or an anecdote you share in the book that really stuck with you as maybe encapsulating what your message with the book is.
Listeners might find interesting and inspiring.
Off the top of my head, in the section on carrot, that's like a really personal story, and it's interesting too because the healer in that story is a man who's called an upsprecher, as my grandmother called him, label of the sprecher, you know, in her Philadelphia accent. So I found that really like moving, you know, because he was somebody who came from the old country, obviously, and helped my family, you know, take care of their little baby, my great aunt. And then it was very sad that the health authorities, you know, Western medicine health authorities, made him shut his practice in the 30s. And he had a large clientele because we've still, since then, I found out that other parts of my family had gone to him. And also Ruchel
Frisson.
Ruchel, do you know Ruchel Frisson? She writes for Tablet, I think it is. Ruchel's Golden City. Her family, I don't think they were from Philadelphia either. They're from New York. They went to this man too, who was in South Philadelphia.
Which is a very Eastern European thing to do, is to go hundreds of miles to be healed by somebody.
Yeah.
And that was, that's actually segues perfectly, because what I was going to say was, not only just recovering the healing practices of a huge community of Ashkenazi Jews, what was it, 6, 8, 7 million, you know, before the Holocaust, but just recovering, you know, the role of Tatars in Eastern European common culture or Karaim Jews. People would go hundreds of miles to go see a Tatar healer, and Tatar healers, who were also mostly men, were renowned for their skill at treating mental afflictions, emotional disturbances, psychological problems. And they show up in the strangest places. One thing that we touch upon, but we didn't really have the space, I'd love to devote more time to it, was we're talking about, you know, different traditions. There are, obviously, in the further south you go in Eastern Europe, into like the Balkan, there's more Sephardim than Ashkenazim. And the exact template that we located in Lithuania and in Poland and Belarus, where you have mixed communities of Orthodox Belarusians, Polish Catholics and Lithuanians, Ashkenazi Jews and Muslim Tatars, you find in Bosnia with Sephardic Jews and Catholic Croats, Orthodox Serbs and Bosnian Muslims. And a lot of affinities, both in the culture of healing that you find in, you know, pre-war Bosnia, Herzegovina, and other places in Southeastern Europe, and that what you find in Northeastern Europe. In terms of also in plant, you know, plant the plants they relied upon and what they relied upon them for. That was like, oh, I got to dive back in. There's still so much more that we didn't even, you know, I think I was telling you guys, I think I have a text file that's like 800,000 words just of notes just for the stuff that we did. None of this went into Woven Roots. I mean, a lot of it, there's just no room for it.
Yeah.
Oh so, my goodness. Save it for your next book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like this is just the beginning of like maybe not even something just you guys create, but it seems right. like as I was saying before, yes. there does yeah. need to be
yeah,
a mean, whole series of
mm-hmm. Jewish ethnobotany.
Jewish yeah. ethnobotanies. Yeah. And yeah. there should be an ethnobotany of Palestine Israel as well oh, yeah. that looks at that.
There
and
is
I think
one.
We've talked about
no.
There's Leila Fagali's book. Do you know that one? The Land in Our Bones.
Yeah.
It's called The Land in Our Bones. Do you guys have it?
I have a copy of it, yeah, on my shelf over here.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are starting to do this, you know? I mm-hmm. mean, there's a woman in our group, the Jewish Herbalists Network, that comes out of the Jewish Farmers Network, and she wrote a book called The Book of Jewish Flowers, and she's part Sephard, so she does a lot of that, incorporating those plants into her book too. So anyhow, I mean, these things, it takes a while for people to really, and it's hard.
It's hard.
Really difficult,
yeah.
you know. Mm-hmm. But here's an interesting thing: we tried but failed. Is there are some still existing Jewish herbalists in Lithuania?
Mm.
Yeah.
That oh, have you get in touch
survived
with them.
The war. Yeah, we tried.
We tried.
We tried really hard to, yeah. but we couldn't make it happen. But yeah. that's an interesting, like older women. So anyhow, it's just kind of yeah. moving that these things, you know, they survive. You know, there's that saying, you know, they didn't know we were seeds, you know. I love
they
that
They tried
saying.
To bury us,
yeah,
but they didn't
exactly.
know we were seeds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I want to thank you both so much for writing this incredible book and for sharing your time so generously with us. If our listeners are interested in getting their own copy of Woven Roots, where can they find it?
Well, actually, Jewitches sells. I mean,
I was going to name Jewitches, actually, when we brought up White Sage, because there's someone that does a lot of this sort of herbal stuff, but they specifically do not carry White Sage because...
Yeah.
Yeah. of how sensitive the plant is and how hyper exploited it is. Mm-hmm. I saw that they're carrying Woven Roots.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely, please, if you're listening to this and like a copy, check out Jew Witches. We'll put a link to the book in the show notes so people can find it easily. Is it in physical bookstores yet?
Yeah, I believe it is.
Appels
has it, Banyan Books.
In Vancouver.
I'll see if our local bookstore, if I ask for it, maybe they'll order some.
Totally,
I'm sure they will.
And libraries,
too. Ask your local library to get a copy,
too. Yeah, libraries. That's a good source, too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your generosity with your time and really, honestly, for reaching out
to us and for your kind words and support of the work.
No, we're so excited to be on talking to you guys.
Yeah.
Being on.
Yeah. And thanks for all the amazing questions. They're really, really thought-provoking and really made me think about so many of, you know, these things I take for granted or haven't even really been aware of. So,
right.
Yeah.
Or stick your fingers in your ear and go, la, 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 la. I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, thanks for your podcast. We love your podcast.
We're so grateful to have you. And we're so grateful for the enriching that you do to helping us understand our traditions that have been, and I don't even want to say lost, because they haven't been lost. They've just been overshadowed by something else. And I think it's so important to recenter these things, because Jewish culture and politics is not one thing, and it's a lot deeper. And I think especially now, people are so hyper focused on the question of Palestine Israel that they can tunnel vision on that and lose that actually we have a lot more, and by bringing out and spreading out what we're looking at, we can ground ourselves in something that is Judaism. It is Jewish culture, it's Jewish tradition, but it's not one thing. It's something that is so diverse internally. And there's so much beauty in that. And I'm really so grateful for the work you've done to not only bring forward this ethnobotanical lens on Ashkenazi Jewish community and culture, but also in how, with Woven Roots, how interwoven that is with the wider social fabric of the region of Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
Definitely our goal. I mean, I just in closing, I know we're conduits. Dietrich and I are just conduits.
Yeah.
You know, we're mediums. We're just putting it out there, you know, but I agree. If I have any goal, it's like that there's other ways of being Jewish in the world.
That's right. Well, thank you for pouring through the archives and finding these documents. We didn't go into it, but I know it's a lot of hard work. You said 800,000 words of notes. A lot of work went into this that nobody will see besides your editor if they're lucky, but I'm so excited to see what comes next, and I am grateful for the wonderful work you're doing.